Parents everywhere are asking questions and wanting help and advice on how to do a better job of rearing their children. Many are searching desperately for whatever bit of helpful information they can find. Well, in this four-cassette package, you're going to hear some of the most practical and helpful advice available anywhere. And to share it with you is one of America's most popular and highly respected authorities on the subjects of parenting and marriage, Dr. James Dobson. A devoted husband and father, Dr. Dobson is a leading Christian psychologist, serving as Associate Clinical Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Southern California School of Medicine. He also serves on the attending staff for Children's Hospital of Los Angeles in the Division of Medical Genetics. Dr. Dobson is more widely known for his numerous best-selling books on parenting and marriage, such books as Dare to Discipline, Hide or Seek, The Strong-Willed Child, and Preparing for Adolescence. In this forte package on questions parents ask about rearing children, you will hear discussed many of the common problems confronting almost every parent. Two of the cassettes feature conversations with Dr. Dobson on a variety of questions often asked about rearing children. The other tapes include discussions about shaping the will without breaking the spirit, masturbation, children's sleep habits, and for new mothers in particular, there's one about depression following childbirth. These presentations have been recorded at various locations. Some are from Dr. Dobson's weekly syndicated radio series, Focus on the Family. One is from a seminar held in San Antonio, Texas, and another was a live radio talk show aired in California, with the listeners being invited to call in and talk personally with Dr. Dobson. It's our sincere desire that each of these cassette recordings will prove to be helpful to you in your own parenting, and if you're a counselor, may they be useful in your ministry of helping others find better ways to rear their children. Now, on this first cassette is a conversation which took place on a special talk show program on KYMS Radio in Santa Ana, California. The host for the program was Gil Meggerly of Domain Agency Incorporated in Chicago, the producer of Dr. Dobson's popular syndicated radio program, Focus on the Family. Joining Gil as an interviewer was Mary Dietrich of San Diego, a lay marriage counselor and speaker, and an author of two books, one on sexual maturity for women, and another entitled It Hurts to Love. The format of the talk show began with Dr. Dobson responding to questions from Mary and Gil, and then listeners to the program were invited to call in and ask Dr. Dobson for answers to their questions. Originally a two-hour program, we have condensed the discussion to about 45 minutes in order to bring you the best of Dr. Dobson's comments on this subject of parents rearing children. And Mary Dietrich started off the questioning.
To get us rolling here, I think I'd like to just throw out one general question to Dr. Dobson and ask you, in your travels and in your counseling with people, how would you evaluate the American family? Where is the family right now?
Well, Mary, I wish I could give an optimistic picture of what I see happening in the family, but I'm afraid my observations are the same as those other people are making. The family's in a great deal of trouble. It's rocking and reeling like a ship on a stormy sea. It's almost, at times for me, as though I'm in combat and shells are going off all around. And, you know, we have this startled reaction. Oh, no, Susie and Bob, you don't mean them. We've known them since the high school years. Oh, you don't mean this family, not that one. And even within the Christian community, we're seeing the same thing happen. And it does concern me a great deal, and that's really why I've chosen to devote a good part of my energies in this direction.
And particularly in regards to children, what do you see happening there in the family?
Well, anytime mothers and fathers are going through stress and distress and conflict and strife, then children are going to be suffering. That's true especially within the Christian community again. You know, someone told me the other day something that I thought was really dramatic. When mothers and fathers are in conflict, when there's a lack of harmony there for the models within the family, it has the same effect on children that it would have on us as Christians if God and the Holy Spirit and Jesus were in conflict. Because our spiritual models, those that we love and follow, are when they're in conflict, then it's unsettling and the entire foundation begins to crumble.
What would you say to a parent who has been struggling to do their best for their children, and now they have discovered that they have a rebel under their roof?
Well, there's no reason for guilt just for having a rebel. You can do everything right, and incidentally, no one does, least of all my wife and me. But even if you did everything right, there is still, within the nature of children, within human nature, that inclination to self-will, to rebellion. I think, frankly, I'm not a theologian and probably am not qualified to make this assessment, but I think that's the essence of inborn sin that we're all born with. It was rebellion that got Adam and Eve in trouble in the Garden of Eden. They knew what God wanted. They said, we won't do it. We know what you want. We won't do it. We won't accept your authority and your leadership. So I see a rebellion among children as nothing to panic over, although parents do panic when they see it. I think you just have to know how to approach it when it occurs and to lead a child through that age and get him into maturity and submit him in the hands of the Lord.
Dr. Dobson, in one of your books on child raising, you refer to what you call releasing your grown child, a process by which parents let go gradually of the authority that they exercise over their children. And here's the statement I want to ask you about. You say that religious people, and particularly Christian parents, are the worst offenders in not letting go of their grown children.
Gil, that's right. And this has been an observation of mine in counseling with Christian parents and watching how they raise their children. And in so many ways, Christian parents do a very superior job of bringing those children into the world and the way they train them and teach them. But this happens to be a particular weakness growing out of how strongly we feel about the outcome of child rearing. And I want to tell you, I'm in that category. I'm not at all neutral about the way I feel about my children. I want them to love the Lord. I want them to be committed to the faith. I want them to marry inside the faith. I want them to go to a Christian school. I want them to not have sex before marriage. I want them, obviously, to have a good marriage and those things. Those things matter probably more to most of us as Christians than to those who don't have a faith, because the outcome is just extremely important to what we believe. And because of that, our tendency is to hold on too tightly. You know, as we approach the end of childhood, we're afraid to open those hands and let those kids go because they might make the wrong decision. They might not do what we want them to do. They might go into sin. They might forget God. They might do all those things we feared from birth. So our tendency is to hold too tightly. Tell them what to do, where to live, who to be with, who to go with, what school to go with, who to marry. When, in fact, our job as mothers and fathers ought to be over, and we have to let go. And I found that many young people coming into early adult life so totally resent that and so much want to be independent and respected as adults in their own life that the only way they can get free of their parents is to deliberately disobey and defy them on all of these behaviors that they really don't want to do. You know, they don't want to oppose their parents, but they have to in order to get them off their back. So our tendency, I think, is to just be too sticky-fingered in the 17, 18, 19, 20, 21 time.
Would you say that that is the only reason that children rebel, is that they're trying to get out from under the authority or the sticky finger of those parents?
You know, Mary, I'm of the opinion, and this is very debatable, but I'm of the opinion that some of that adolescent rebellion is not only healthy, but it was probably designed by God because it is so universal. I mean, it's in nearly every family at some point or another. And it is the process by which a child changes from a little boy or a little girl taking orders from the parents and looking to the parents for all good things to an adult in his own right. That's the process, and it involves ripping and tearing of flesh. And without that rebellion, I can see in many cases how you can have a retarded, an emotionally retarded adult still looking to his parents in that same relationship that they had 10 years earlier if they hadn't gone through that time of trial and testing. So I don't think we should panic when that occurs. We handle it very differently, in fact, than rebellion for a 3-year-old. That I feel much more strongly about.
That reminds me of another question about the scripture, not to provoke your children to wrath. And would you like to make any other comments in regards to inciting your children to rebellion?
You know, I have on the cover of Dare to Discipline a little scale with love on one side and control on the other. And I see the healthy home as one where those factors are in balance, where the child knows he's loved, but where he has some obligations to respond and respect the leadership of his parents. When you tip that scale either direction, you get into trouble. When there's an oppressive atmosphere, you know, great control and no love, you destroy a child. When you tip it the other direction, you've got overprotection and super love, but absolutely no control. You've got trouble. Now, see, that little scale is based on the scripture you just read and another one having to do with fathers. It's proper for you to control and command the respect of your children. See, so those two things. Now, this one that you just mentioned, I think, cautions us against the matter of oppressiveness and anger and capriciousness and hostility, where you come home tired, you're big, he's little, and you slap him across the mouth, you know. And if he makes a mistake or he says something that you don't like, you're down his neck. And where he lives in a fear relationship, that's not healthy, and it's not what God wanted. That's what that scripture cautions against. But also, the other scripture says that we are in charge. Children, obey your parents, for this is God's will concerning you. See, when you get those two things in balance, I think you have healthy children.
Dr. Dobson, make a sweeping analysis of whether American parents err on the side of love or on the side of control.
I think right now, Gil, there is mass confusion, and parents are wandering back and forth between those extremes, not knowing what in the world they should do, not having a game plan. I said in one of my books, I wish they could hear you cheering, Mary. You got your arm in the air and everything. I said in one of my books that a friend of mine was flying a plane back 25 years ago, and he made the mistake of flying too long, and by the time he got back to the airport, there were no lights, and he couldn't see the airport, and he was stuck up there with no lights on his plane. And he circled and circled and knew as soon as he ran out of gas that he was going to crash. And you can imagine the tension that he went through. And somebody on the ground, some merciful man, heard that engine up there and drove back and forth on that dark little country runway, and then finally parked his car at one end and let the lights shine on the runway, and my friend landed his plane safely in the lights of that car. I think of that whenever I'm coming in for a landing at L.A. International in the evening, and I see the green runway lights that show where the plane should go. See, there are borders on that runway, and a pilot knows that if he brings his plane down inside those borders, then everything will be safe. But if he veers to either side, he's in trouble. And what it seems to me that we need as parents are those guidelines, those lights, those runway lights that show parents where to bring in the ship. And I think those principles are not obtained from me or any other so-called expert or authority, but from the Creator of children. You see? He's got the answers. He made them. He's the manufacturer. Consult the owner's manual. And I think we can raise our children with much more confidence.
That's good to hear. That takes some of the responsibility off of their shoulders. I am thinking now of those that are listening, and perhaps not both of the parents are tuned in to this principle that you have just mentioned. What do you do then?
I think in all areas of life, Mary, there are things that are less perfect than you'd like it to be. You know, life itself is filled with imperfection, and marriage is filled with imperfection. And there are situations where husbands are not comfortable in their role as fathers. They're not doing the job they ought to do, and they can't do it. They weren't trained to do it. They had no models for it in the early years. If that happens, I think a wife should do the best she can to inform him, get him involved and committed, and help him understand, and then make the best of a difficult situation. You can let that tear you all apart, but in all of life, we have to accept reality as it is and not let it destroy us.
Do I understand you're saying that the women should move on without their husbands in the spiritual?
I think you're hearing me say that, and that's a controversial statement that'll get my ears pinned back by certain people. But she has two choices, Mary. After all, you know, she can either wait for her husband to take the spiritual leadership, as many people would suggest, not take the kids to church and not read the Bible with the family and just allow there to be no spiritual tone in the family. Or she's going to get them up and get them going. And if there were just the two of them, the husband and wife, she could afford to wait. But there is a critical period for teaching children spiritual values. And if you miss it, it's very hard to do it 10 years later. And I've seen a lot of situations where a wife waited for her husband and he came in 10 years or 20 years or 30 years too late. And I think if the father is not going to assume spiritual leadership, the wife has got to do it.
I've read your writing on so many facets, Doctor, of the marriage relationship and child raising. And if I had to guess about the one aspect of the whole family scene that you get a kick out of dealing with more than any other, I'd say the fascinating world of toddlerhood.
How much time you got, Gary? I love toddlers. They're fascinating, as you said. They say the quotable things, the little fat fingers, you know, they end everything. They're a hazard and a danger to themselves and the whole world. But that's what makes them interesting and exciting to me. Everything is new. You know, we've worn it all out. We know what China cups look like. We know what China cups are like. We've held many of them. We're no longer interested in China cups. A toddler is fascinated with a China cup. He wants to pick it up and taste it and listen to it and smell it and throw it through the air and marvel at the wondrous sounds it makes when it breaks, you know. Toddlers just love that kind of stuff, and they're interested in everything. They want to look in every drawer, and they want to disassemble everything and render it inoperable. And it's an extremely frustrating time for mothers. I think we ought to admit that. Tough time. I think it's tougher than adolescence. But at the same time, it's a priceless time that we'll look back on with very warm memories, I think.
You've hit a nerve with me because I have a little 14-month toddler in our home.
Do you really?
Yes, my little granddaughter. But when I think of that little toddler and discipline towards her, of course, Grandma doesn't want any. How do you discipline a little person like that?
Very carefully. You will never make a toddler act like an adult. You just can't do it. It's not in their nature. It's a very negative phase of life where everything is no. You know, no, they don't want to put on their snowsuit. No, they don't want to brush their teeth. No, they don't want to go outside. They'll even say no when you're handing them ice cream. They take the ice cream and say no when they're taking it, you know. So you don't expect them to act like adults. But you gradually, over a period of about 2 years, get across two messages to toddlers. One, I love you, little one. You couldn't imagine how much I love you. I'd lay down my life for you. You have worth. You have dignity. But at the same time, you have some responsibilities to obey me. I am your mother. I am your father. God has given me the job to teach you, and you will obey me. And when I tell you to do something, you've got to do it. Because I love you enough to see that you do it.
Does that hold for Grandma, too?
Yes, with the permission of Mama. I think that that grandmothers play an extremely important role in the life of a child. But it is with the advice and consent of the mother. You know, I think grandmothers have to be cautious not to usurp that role because they had their shot and now they're in a secondary role. Can I add something to that? I want to underline something that I feel very strongly, more right this moment than I have probably 2 or 3 years ago or even 6 months ago. I want to say something to the parent out there who is really struggling and going through it. And it's time that we admitted that it happens. Parenthood is a guilty affair. Parenthood is saturated with guilt. You can never do the job right, no matter how much you pour yourself in it. You always feel you've blown it because the human personality is so complex and children are so incredibly complicated and that rebellious spirit that's there. You never feel really good about what you've done except for a short period of time, which is very quickly blown a few days later. And I don't think God expects us to live under that cloud of guilt. I think we do the best job we can and we give it to Him and let Him take the rest of it, you know, and say, Lord, I know that I'm making mistakes, but I'm doing the best I can. Cover up for them, will you? Help me with it. And I submit myself to you, and I ask for your leadership, and I believe He'll do it.
Oh, there are a lot of parents that are rejoicing over those remarks and appreciate them, I know.
I did a little survey last weekend of 3,000 people in San Antonio where we spoke on the strong-willed child, and I asked them to comment on their feelings about raising the strong-willed child. What amazed me is there were three categories that they could check. A, raising this child has been extremely difficult, which has left me often depressed, emotionally upset, fatigued, and it's been a very harried experience. B, it's been difficult, but it's been rewarding too. And C, it's been a very positive affair. Would you believe only 5% of the results that I've tabulated so far marked C? And 57% said C, and 30-something percent said A. I think it was 37% so far. I haven't tabulated them all, but 37% said it's been tough.
You're listening to a one-way special on the family with Dr. James Dobson. Thank you very much for waiting. What would you like to ask Dr. Dobson?
Yeah, my name is Floyd, and I have a boy, 7, 1, 5, and a girl, 1 year. And my question, first of all, was how do you know when the child, whether it be a boy or a girl, when it's time to sit down and discuss the facts of life with them?
Your question almost implies that there is one time to sit down and talk about the facts of life. And that's really not the case. I think it ought to come up sequentially all through childhood. And let me see, without having a chance to prepare this, let me see if I can lay down the sequence.
Okay.
In the preschool years, it should come to a child's attention at some point in there that babies are formed inside the mother. And I think it's appropriate at that time to give the names of body parts.
Right.
And to let them know that this is where babies come from. They don't come from storks and all these other spooky stories.
Right.
You give them that idea.
Yeah.
All right. Then in the early elementary school years, they should get a little more information about the anatomy and physiology, where the babies come out, what the vagina is, a little bit more about perhaps the uterus. You go into just a little more about the nature of the birthing process, but you still have not told them how the baby starts, how it gets there. You haven't discussed intercourse with the child. At some point, probably between 7 and 9, in this culture it could be even earlier, but probably 7 and 9 or maybe as late as 10, the child will ask that critical question, and you got to be prepared for it because it just comes out of the blue. Yeah, but Daddy, how does it get there? You know, and you got to be ready for that. At that point, you perhaps say, I tell you what, let's fix us some hot chocolate and let's go get up on the bed and let's talk about that. And you discuss the concept of intercourse with the child for the first time. It'll probably bring a reaction of yuck at that stage. That usually occurs, but that's part of it. You still do not tell them at that age about the pleasure involved in adult sexuality. I don't think they need to know that yet.
Good.
But then probably prior to puberty, maybe 10 or 11 years of age, depending on the development of the child, you finish that discussion and go into adult sexuality. The fact that intercourse is had not just to create babies, but because it's a form of love and expression between a husband and wife, and you go into the morality of that. So it's a sequential pattern through childhood.
Good.
And if the child does not ask the right questions, you have the obligation to stimulate those questions. But it's better to be prepared for those moments when the questions come up naturally.
Thank you. That's a very good answer, I feel. And I have one more question, if I may.
All right.
We would also like to know, my wife and I, how do you know is the right time to start disciplining as far as the physical discipline of spanking of a child?
You have a one-year-old, don't you?
Yes.
I'm a little nervous about physical punishment for a child that age. I'm more than a little nervous about it because the last thing I want to do is send parents out to abuse children. There's an awful lot of that going on already. I think you start probably at, say, 15 months of age, thumping the fingers.
Mm-hmm.
Not because the child is reaching for pretty interesting things. That's part of childhood. You should let him do that. But maybe he's reaching for a stove,
mm-hmm.
or the electric light outlet or something of that nature that you know will be harmful for him. And you say no, and he continues to reach. And you say no, and he reaches. And he hears you say no, but he's defying you. And you let him get almost to it and then thump his little fingers. Then at about 18 months of age, in response to willful defiance now, not in response to irresponsibility,
mm-hmm.
but in response to willful defiance, where he knows what you want and he says, I won't do it, then I think one little swat on the legs that would sting, not through 4 wet diapers, which won't sting, I think would be appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And then as you get into the 2s, then 2 or 3 swats would probably do it. You never have to beat a child. because it just isn't necessary, and that can be dangerous.
Thank you very much.
All right. Good night.
And thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Dr. Dobson.
Hello there.
I'd like to know, how would you break a child from biting other children?
How old is he?
About 23 months.
You handle it a little different if he's 18 years than 23 months, I think. This is going to sound unbelievably brutal to some of our listeners, and some may absolutely gasp, but I would bite him back. You see, you know what you're doing? You're showing him that that hurts, and you're explaining why you're telling him not to do that anymore. I wouldn't bite him real hard, but children frequently don't know what it feels like to be bitten. And I think, first of all, you show him, and then you tell him why he must not do that anymore. It's part of being 23 months old. That's quite a weapon that they have, and they use most of the things at their fingertips or teeth.
Okay. I've been doing that.
I'm sure that's not the only kind of aggressive act you're seeing from him, is it?
No.
Does he also grab toys away from other kids?
Yes, and he throws them.
Yeah. Well, he's a whole lot like my son was, as a matter of fact. I went to pick up my son when he was just that age, and just really learning to talk, and he'd stayed with a babysitter that had about six kids. And we went and picked him up, and I said, "You have fun, Ryan?" He said, "Yes." I said, "What you been doing all day?" He said, "Grabbing toys."
My son's name.
Is that right? Well, that's part of toddlerhood, and I think it's only one of the thousands of things you got to cope with.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
In the area of discipline, Dr. Dobson, as long as that child is under your roof and eating your food, does the age of spanking continue?
No, I think it's a great mistake to spank a child into the adolescent years, because a teenager has an obsession to grow up and be an adult. Much of the rebellion of the teen years grows out of the fact that in our culture, kids are in between childhood and adulthood for a longer period of time than any other culture in the history of the world. From as early as maybe 10 years of age, in some kids, especially girls, to as late as 25, if you're still getting money from your parents to go to college, you are not a full-fledged adult. You're an in-between person. And so children at that time resent very much you're treating them as babies and as children. And so spankings are the way you treated them when they were 3, 4, and 5. And it's a supreme insult, and I don't think that you should do it. Besides that, the pain of a spanking is no longer a major motivator to an adolescent. I think if you do the job right, spankings ought to be just about over by 10 or 11. And in the case of some strong-willed children, at 12, they'll say one more time, "Do you still have the courage? You still want to fight? Prove it to me one more time." But once they get into the teen years, you approach it different ways.
Is it denial and restriction then?
Yes, you have the keys to the car that he wants, and you've got the money that he needs and the privileges to go places. And I think you just level with him, and you say, "John, you know that you got to do what I tell you to do on certain things, and you're pushing and shoving, and you don't give me any choice, so I'm going to play the game with you, and I'll try to think up ways to make you miserable, and you've got to go along with me on those things I can't compromise on. On the other hand, I do care about what you feel, and I do want to know what you think. And if I've been unfair, I'll listen to you, and I will compromise every way that I can."
You're listening to Dr. James Dobson. You're on the air. Can we help you?
Hi, I had a question. I don't have any children of my own as of yet, but I've had a question that's been floating on the top of my mind for a couple of years, so this is coming in good.
Good.
Okay, I was not raised in the church. Okay, my mother had gone to church, and she said, "When you want to come, that's fine." Okay, I rebelled. I went into the worldly things. But when I was still young, I accepted the Lord, and I've been walking with the Lord, okay? But it was when I was still young, like early teens, like 13, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And yet I see other young people that age in the church, like the deacons' daughters and all that, who are in total rebellion. Their parents make them go to church. What am I going to do when I have kids? Do I make them go to church and watch them rebel totally? Or do I say, "Well, if you want to come," I mean, what do you do with that?
I think it's very fortunate for you that you found the Lord, despite the fact that you didn't have the proper training and that your parents didn't lead the way,
mm-hmm.
because it's unlikely that that would have occurred. It does happen. Obviously, it did happen in your case. But in most cases, Either the parents lead the child and show him and serve as models themselves, and even through the rebellious period, they continue in a quiet way to lead, or the child will often choose the other way. And I feel it's a great mistake to kind of remain neutral on that point, because when that happens, you frequently get the wrong answer. I, speaking for myself and my children, I care very much about the outcome, and I'm not at all neutral on that issue. And I'm doing everything I can in the early days to instill those values that I care about. But let me add one other thing that I think is probably more direct to your point.
Okay.
The rebellion that you're talking about seeing in others that are in the teen years is part of the process of changing that religion from being the views of the parent to the views of the child. Mm. You go through a time where you have to look at it yourself and say, hey, wait a minute. Is this really what I care about? Is this really what I want? Or is this something I've been just talked into by my parents? Is this their religion or is it for real? And it's very hard for parents during that time to kind of let go and let the child look at it and let it become his own. And so there's a few delicate years there where there's a strain over that issue, particularly in solid Christian homes.
Right.
So part of that rebellion is normal and natural, and I don't think we should panic when it occurs.
So you just kind of, you still make them go to church, but you just kind of let them make the decision themselves.
Yeah. I think during that time, you don't deal with them with a great heavy hand. You just quietly say, you know how strongly we feel about this. This is the most important issue in life. And when you're in this house, this is the way we're going to go. You know, as for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord. Mm-hmm. And not try to force them to make all the right noises and say all the right things. Don't agitate them on it, but try to get them through that time of questioning without all-out rebellion.
Right.
Does that help?
Thanks a lot, yeah.
Sure, thanks for calling. You're listening to Dr. James Dobson. You're on the air. Can we help you?
Hi. We have four children, ages 5 and a half and under, and my husband and I had a question on mainly the 4 and 5-year-old. They seem to be very unappreciative lately. An example I could give would be we might on a particular night let them have a dessert and then, you know, tell them maybe 3 stories rather than the usual one.
Yes.
And let them stay up quite a bit longer than they usually would. And then when they're ready to go to bed after all this, we've given them this, they really scream and, you know, gee, why do we have to go to bed? Mm-hmm. And things like that mostly, that they just seem to not appreciate that type of thing. It isn't so much material things, but...
Children are not overwhelmed with an excessive amount of appreciation. I think that's something that frustrates all parents. They do and do and do for them, give to them, work for them, slave for them. And they hardly even recognize it. And if they even say a please or a thank you, it's because you demanded it or required it. So what they're doing is what all children are doing at that age. But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't take steps to teach them to be appreciative. And I think when that occurs, you sit down with them and give them the scoreboard. Tell them what's on it. You know, you seem to forget that I did this and I did that, and then I took you out for ice cream, and then we came home and I read you a story. And I also have my own responsibilities, and I think I've met mine to you, and I don't think you've been very appreciative about it. Mm-hmm. I think you can teach that by your manner. I also think it's helpful to teach children to say please and thank you, because in spite of the fact that we're doing all the giving, that's the way of saying to a child that it's not a gimme gimme world, and there is something expected back from you on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, after you've said it and they don't do it, and you've said it and they don't do it, then you have to do something to get their attention, like sit on a chair for 15 minutes and think about the word thank you as many times as possible. There comes a point where you do not yield to the pressure of that kind of complaint department. You know, children will use whatever tools are available, whatever works, they'll use it. And if their objective is to stay up another 30 minutes and they can accomplish that by yelling that you haven't done enough, then they're going to yell that way. You just have to see that it doesn't succeed.
If I had one other quick question, if I could.
All right.
It was on when I'm with the children in the day, the four small ones. If we've been out in a store, I've always tried to verbally correct them and tell them over and over again. A lot of times I have to not do something rather than to spank them in public, because I know that can embarrass them. But Lately, I've been resorting to doing some spanking if I'm out at the store because they just don't seem to listen. Last night was a good, for instance, I took the 4- and the 5-year-old to a supermarket, and they kept climbing up on the turnstile little deal.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And, you know, really, they're big for their age, too, but I mean, I just felt they really don't need to be doing this, and I kept calling to them to stop this, and they wouldn't, so I finally had to go over there, and I don't know, is it good to spank them in public, or...
Well, first of all, talk is the poorest motivator of children. They don't care what you have to say. You can say that 105 times, and that doesn't mean one thing. And when you realize you've said it once, and they heard you, and then they don't respond, you need to take some action of some sort or another. Now, spanking is one form of action that you can take that's usually pretty effective. And if you're worried about doing it in public, then take the child by the hand and go outside and go out behind the car and give him what he was suggesting or asking for. Or if he's a little older, you can't do this with a toddler, but if he's, say, 7 years of age and he's doing that, he can remember till he gets home.
Thank you so much.
Right.
Hi, Dr. Dobson.
Yes.
Hi. My husband and I have a 20-month-old little boy who is so adorable and just total energy.
And I know him well.
There are times when my husband and I disagree on ways of child rearing, and I wanted to ask your help or suggestion in one particular issue that we've really gotten a lot of disagreements about.
All right.
Since we've been married, my husband and I have tried to every day have a time of Bible reading together, and it's been a very special family time for us.
Yes.
And since our little boy is older now, he tries to, you know, to sit with us and share with us while we're doing this, but many times, and just the fact that he's 21 months old, you know, he is distracted.
Yes.
And this upsets my husband very much, and he tries to get him to sit quietly while we do this, and I try to explain that I don't think there's any way that a 20-month-old can sit quietly for more than about 2 seconds. And we get in arguments and things like that about this, and I'm wondering if there's any suggestions you might have about how we could have this special time together without it being a big scene.
Well, I hate to get myself in between you and your husband on this argument, but I'm afraid I'm going to have to side with you that it is absolutely out of step, out of sync with his development to expect a 21-month-old to hold still while adult kinds of conversation are going on.
Right.
I've never seen a 21-month-old in my life that could do that.
Right.
Not
okay.
A one.
We have tried doing things like getting him a little book to read while we're sitting reading our book and things like that, and is there anything you can think of to do that we could occupy him with?
Well, there's only one thing better than that, and that's having your devotions when he's taking a nap.
Fine.
You know, even reading a book, the attention span of a 21-month-old is so short
right. That
he's going to be up and around.
My problem has been, you know, because I really love my husband and I desire to respect his authority and things like that, but this is one thing that I really felt strongly about. Okay, I just wanted to let you know that I really appreciate your ministry, and we've grown a lot from it, and we just wanted to thank you.
That's neat.
Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you.
Thanks for calling.
You're listening to a one-way special on the family with Dr. James Dobson. You're on the air with Dr. Dobson.
Hi, I have a 3-year-old son who lies constantly, and I have explained to him, you know, that lying is not the thing to do, and that people won't believe him if, you know, even when he's telling the truth. And we've had spankings and spankings, and he still is lying to me.
Hmm. I hear him in the background, don't I?
Yes.
Yes. You know, your question falls in the category of a number of others that have come. And I suppose we could express it this way. What do I do after I've explained and the behavior doesn't change?
Mm-hmm.
If a spanking does not keep your 3-year-old from lying, then how about sitting on a chair for about 15 minutes? The 3-year-old hates to sit on a chair. That is sometimes a much greater motivator than a spanking for
uh-huh.
a 3-year-old. Now, let me ask you a very important question. In our whole conversation, this is number one. What would he do if you put him in a chair and told him to stay there? Would he get up?
I hope not.
Could you keep him on a chair?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Without holding him there?
Mm-hmm.
He will do what you tell him to do?
Yes. With the threat of a spanking, usually.
Yeah. In a situation like that, a 3-year-old frequently will not. And that's the best test as to whether or not a mother has control. Because
mm-hmm.
if you can't keep him on a chair, then you're really not in charge. I think I would put him there and let him think about it for 15 minutes. and then get down and pray about it, and give yourself time to get this message across to him. See, he's only three. He's mm-hmm. not grown. And you consistently work on it, but don't panic, because there's a lot you can't get out of a three-year-old immediately. It has to come in time. And this is something that I agree you ought to be working on, but it's not something where you expect instant success, because you're dealing with a very immature little mind. Is he also challenging you and pushing you pretty hard?
Yes, he does.
Do I hear a good bit of discouragement in your voice?
Yes.
Tell me how you're discouraged. It's not just lying that's bothering you, is it?
Well, I have a son that's 15 months old that has cerebral palsy.
Oh.
And Big Brother has had a very bad reaction to all the special school, and that's when the lying started and a few other things. It's been about 3 months.
How handicapped is your CP
child?
He's
very handicapped. He can't... He rolls over, and that's the extent of his activity. And he's going to special schooling and getting a lot of special attention for it.
How have you coped with that tragedy?
Well, I know that we don't get anything that we can't handle through the Lord. So I'm
Are you handling
it? Off.
Are you handling it?
I'm not. The Lord is.
Yeah.
Through the Lord, I can.
He will help you, too. And it's very difficult to answer the whys of life, especially one that involves a little child who hurts and doesn't know why. And there is no explanation for that, other than the fact that we know that, as you said, God won't give you anything that you can't cope with, and he will be with you, and he will support you. Are you able to ventilate your feelings to anybody? Do you have people close to you that you can just sometimes say all the things that Christians ordinarily aren't supposed to say? Like, I feel like I'm going to go crazy. I feel like I'm going to lose my mind. This is the most depressing thing I've ever gone through. Are you ever able to say that?
Oh, yes. My family's all real close here.
Oh, that's good. Is your husband involved with the family?
He's not in the home. He lives in the area, but he's not in the home anymore.
I see. Boy, my heart goes out to you. You know, there's some people that are asked to carry more than their share, it seems like. And I reach out to you in love and in prayer at this moment. And all I can tell you is that God will not let you drown, even though the waves are splashing all over you. It's funny, when you asked that first question, I heard a whole lot more in your voice than what the question implied. And I heard all of what you're saying at this moment. How long have you been a Christian?
3 years.
You have 2 children?
Yes.
Do you have a good physician?
Yes.
And does he give you a lot of support?
Oh, yes. He's real good.
Is the program your older child is in,
it's
something
that's... It's the younger child. It's in a special program.
The younger child.
Uh-huh. He's 15 months.
I see. Well, I appreciate your calling, and there are a lot of things, a lot of programs that are available for a handicapped child, and I wish that I had magic solutions for you, but I don't, but I do express my love for you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for calling.
Okay. God bless you.
God bless you. Boy, that's tough. That is so tough, so hard. Having a handicapped child... with all that implies, it'd take that mother 2 or 3 weeks to explain what she's experienced and what you've gone through. I've seen it there at the hospital, and it's indescribable, really.
Thank you for calling us, and what can we do for you?
Yeah, I just, first of all, want to thank the Lord that Jesus has really just brought something beautiful like this program to the air.
Well, what a neat thing to say. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, I've really been deeply moved, especially... for the last sister that just called in. Oh. And, you said there was nothing magical that you could do, but the Lord just brought it to my heart that, and I know you felt it, that
sure.
Prayer is just, that's the magic that we can do.
Would you believe I was just sitting here thinking that, and I appreciate your giving me the opportunity, to ask those believers in the audience, those that heard that conversation, and those that know the Lord, and know him in a personal way, to remember her in prayer.
Yeah.
Because, boy, I tell you, she's got a load. Here she is handling these kids and a handicapped child with no man in the house. And it's hard enough doing that job when you got a strong marriage.
Oh, yeah.
And we don't know the details of how our marriage split up, but there's probably some pain there, too.
Oh, definitely.
And I just wish everybody would undergird her, because God loves her.
Oh,
you know,
for sure.
And I believe he's going to help her.
Oh, I believe that.
Mm-hmm.
Praise the Lord.
Thank you for calling.
One of the good things about the day in which we live, when you hear a story like that, is the tremendous number of fabulous books a person can curl up with and find some encouragement and find some answers. In fact, there is an absolute explosion going on in recent years in terms of the publication of fabulous Christian books in many areas of life. Let me give you a couple of titles that may help you. The interviewing this evening is being done by Mary Dietrich, who's the author of Sexual Maturity for Women. You can get that book at your Christian bookstore. She deals with the aspects of leaving and cleaving to your new mate, the business of the difference between men and women, some techniques in the bedroom is a chapter, and the whole meaning of love is the conclusion of the book. The title again is Sexual Maturity for Women. Here are the books that have been written by Dr. James Dobson. His most recent book is Preparing for Adolescence, on getting our kids ready for the teenage years. Fabulous concept and what parents should do with their kids.
Gil, if I can interrupt you, it's not for parents primarily, although parents read it. It's really written for the child. It is in the language of kids, and it's to prepare them. It's for, so they can see what's coming in the adolescent years.
And it's for the 11 or 12-year-old?
Actually, about 10 to 14, but primarily pre-puberty. That's where it was aimed. And there's a set of tapes, of course, that goes with it.
Preparing for Adolescence is the title there. The book before that this spring was The Strong-Willed Child. It doesn't need any explanation. He's written What Wives Wish Their Husbands Knew About Women.
And that needs a lot of explanation.
We won't get into that. And, of course, you're familiar with Dare to Discipline. And then the final book he's written is Hide or Seek.
That's correct. Everybody says hide and seek.
Hide or seek on the whole area of self-esteem or self-worth for your children. A whole book on that subject. Incredible. The attention that can be given and the wealth of importance that can be drawn from that. We've talked about a lot of problems. I want to ask you one more question, Dr. Dobson. What's your dream for the family? What should family living really be all about? What are we aiming towards?
Oh, my. How much time did you say I have? 1 minute. I think, first of all, it'd be a family where every member of the family knows he's loved. Everybody needs love. We don't make it very well without love. Where children come out knowing that they're cared for, not only by the parents and the other siblings, but by God. And also it would be an organization or a unit where values are taught and where children know what they believe and what they care about, where purposes are instilled, and where maybe finally people learn to live with the imperfections in the others around them, because they're going to face them everywhere in life. I've never been in a business. I've never been in an organization that wasn't shot full of human imperfection. And in maybe the family is the best place to learn how to live with that.
Our interviewer has been Mary Dietrich from San Diego. And the host has been Dr. James Dobson, psychologist and author. And if there's been anything he said over the time that I've known him that's impressed me, it's a simple statement that said, if something's going to be done about the deterioration in the American family, some people are just plain going to have to get excited about it. It's not enough to know there's a problem. It's not enough to be able even to articulate the problem. Some of us are going to have to say to ourselves, now is the time to make a move. We're going to make the family a priority. We're going to set some standards and set aside some things of less importance. And as parents, and especially as Christians, we're going to do something about strengthening our families.